All right, good day and good evening to everyone. Welcome to the History of Zionism, Part 5. Tonight we're discussing Theodor Herzl, and we're sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas Yonah Ben Rav Aryeh Leib. Theodor Herzl was one of the most remarkable and unusual figures in Jewish history. You see the iconic image in back of me, living proof of the maxim, Harve Shluchim Lamokom, that God has many agents. So undoubtedly, if Herzl had demurred for whatever reason, Revach Vatzalo Yamod Laihudimi Makom Acher, God has many players on his roster to whom he can assign different tasks and through which Jewish sovereignty over the land of Israel would have been restored. But it was Herzl, a most unlikely individual, who did it. So unlikely that his mere personality and lack of attachment to Torah undermined whatever credibility he might have had with much of the Torah world. Nevertheless, to say that he wasn't a Shaliach Hashem, a divine agent, is to have your head in the sand. And if the beginning of the Geula, the redemption, came about through this idiosyncratic personality, we just have to bow our heads before the Tumim Deot and say, this was the Ratzon Hashem, it was God's will. Why it came about this way, we can speculate, as Rav Kook did. But if this was the way, we're being taught that this too was God's will. For sure, as we've seen, Herzl did not come to Zionism in a vacuum. His grandfather, Shimon Leib Herzl, had a relationship with Rav Yehuda Alkali in Serbia, davened in the same shul, and Herzl knew his grandfather, but he, the grandfather, was an indirect, not a direct influence, as Herzl's life was a strange odyssey that took him far from traditional Jewish life and easily could have taken another direction. The fact that he was completely assimilated and that he has, for example, no living descendants, itself shows how different Herzl was, how unique. Unfortunately, one of Herzl's daughters died of a drug overdose. His only son, who had converted to multiple religions, shot himself to death when he heard his sister died, and his youngest daughter died in Theresienstadt. She had Herzl's only grandson, and he jumped off a bridge in 1946 and killed himself. So given Herzl's upbringing and his choices in life, it's an absolute mystery why we ever heard of him and why he chose to become involved in Zionism. By all rights, like tens of thousands of others, he should have assimilated and disappeared. And yet he's the only person for whom a city is named in Israel. He must have more streets named after him than any other person. He's the only individual named in the Megillat Atzmaut, Israel's scroll of independence, and the man who put Herzl, who put Zionism on the global map and was the catalyst for the Jewish national idea in a way that all of his predecessors, religious and less so, had failed to do. So what was his uniqueness? And how did he accomplish what he accomplished? Binyamin Zev Herzl was born in Budapest, actually in Pest, in 1860. And his parents were Jeanette and Yaakov Herzl. His birthplace can be visited today. It's a museum right next door to the Dohany Street Synagogue in Budapest. His parents had abandoned the observance of Herzl's grandfather, but they still had some attachment to tradition. They, in fact, were neologues, the movement with which the Dohany Street Synagogue identified, similar to what once was conservative Judaism, although they were more respectful of halacha. As far as I can recall, they had separate seating. They also had an organ that was played by non-Jews. But whatever the movement professed, the laity did their own thing, and it's fair to say that Herzl was raised with less and less observance until by the time he was a young adult, he had completely assimilated. He never embraced any form of observance at all, going so far as to refuse to give his only son, Hans, a Brit Milah. Herzl was a dreamer, impressed with himself, given to flights of fancy about his talents and intelligence, and extremely charismatic. He thought of becoming an engineer. He wasn't scientifically inclined. And when the family moved to Vienna in 1878, he attended the University of Vienna, studied law. He briefly practiced law, but then he veered into journalism and playwriting. He became a writer for a Viennese newspaper, the Neue Freie Press, and that became the forum in which he articulated his early views. He was an inveterate diarist also, so we have a lot of information about Herzl that's firsthand. He also wrote plays, none of which were successful, to his great surprise and chagrin. In 1889, age 29 years old, he married a Jewish woman, Julie Naschauer, the daughter of a wealthy businessman, so he didn't lack for money, but their marriage was always troubled. And if you think about it, they're only married for 15 years. He died in 1904, and she took very little interest in his Zionism. In turn, he wound up away from home for long stretches of time, which probably played a role, not a positive role, in his children's upbringing. Herzl was enamored with German culture and language, as were his parents. It was the language in which he was raised. He knew very little Hebrew. He wanted nothing more than to escape Judaism, and yet he couldn't. It is so bitterly ironic that his son Hans, who converted to Protestantism and then to Catholicism, wrote in his suicide note, "A Jew remains a Jew. And tonight I have said Kaddish for my parents and for myself." But he said it in a very harsh, self-critical, self-deprecating way. He hated the fact that he was a Jew, and he couldn't accept it. Theodor Herzl in university joined the German nationalist fraternity, but he resigned in protest of their open advocacy of Jew hatred, the term anti-Semitism having been coined just a few years before. So he too couldn't escape, although he tried. He became obsessed with the Jewish condition and finding some resolution to the Jewish problem. He was irritated by Hungarian Jews whom he found too parochial, notwithstanding the liberal environment in which he was raised. So he first suggested in writing that all Jews undergo social re-education, so they would be acceptable in Christian society. When that found no takers, he published an article in which he called on the Pope to renounce Jew hatred, in exchange for which he would lead, he wrote, a great mass movement for the free and honorable conversion of all Jews to Christianity. He was ignored in this as well, and the Jewish condition continued to gnaw at him. We've already discussed in the past the mercurial Nathan Birnbaum, a seeker, spiritual seeker, an out-of-the-box thinker just like Herzl, who invented the term Zionism in 1890, and it was also Viennese. The paths did cross, as we'll see, but it doesn't seem like it crossed in the early 1890s. Later it would. But Birnbaum already in 1893 published a pamphlet entitled "The Rejuvenation of the Jewish Nation as a Solution to the Jewish Problem." He wrote, I quote, "Even if the individual Jew has a homeland, at present the nation does not, and that is our tragedy." And he posited something that Herzl would later embrace, the notion that if, I quote, "if a Jewish national center were formed in the land of Israel, its impact would be a strengthening of moral and national awareness throughout the diaspora." That part was accurate. This was not, Birnbaum wrote. "The standing of the Jewish nation among the Gentiles would change too. So the thought that a Jewish homeland would solve the question of Jew hatred was presumed by Herzl, by Birnbaum, and many others as well. As we know, that's been proven false. If anything, Israel has given Jew haters a convenient and central target for their Jew hatred. But Birnbaum did note that if the problem of Jew hatred was not solved, at the very least, a Jewish national entity among the family of nations would be able to protest, and Jews would have a place to flee. So he wrote, "Give us a land. That is the secret of the solution to the Jewish problem." So Birnbaum called for a conference of Zionist organizations. Remember, there are chapters of Chovetzin across Europe now. In early 1894, it was convened in Paris, and nothing came of it. He, like others before him, was stymied by apathy and the lack of public support. Some catalyst was needed, someone who would capture the public imagination, put Zionism on the world map, and make it a political factor. And that is where Theodor Herzl entered our world. By 1894, Herzl was the Paris correspondent for the Nea Freia Press, and in that capacity, he covered the Dreyfus trial. So much has been written about the influence of the fate of Alfred Dreyfus on Herzl's Zionist tendencies. The recent literature prefers to discount it, even as Herzl himself wrote that it profoundly shaped his views, but that might have been self-serving. I tend to think it played an important but not determinative role. Important because when it occurred, he had run out of ideas. So it served to crystallize Herzl's views and take it to the next level. Briefly, Captain Alfred Dreyfus was a French army officer who served with distinction and then was set up to take the fall in an espionage case. He was convicted of passing French secrets to the Germans about artillery development. He was convicted, stripped of his rank, degraded to ceremony in the courtyard of what's today the defense ministry, jeered as a Jew in public. He was the only known Jew on the general staff, was completely assimilated also. Crowds gathered, chanting death to the Jews, death to the traitor, as he was paraded about before being incarcerated. As he was walking around the courtyard, I was there years ago for a ceremony, he cried out his innocence. "I swear that I am innocent. I remain worthy of serving in the army. Long live France. Long live the army." He was sent to Devil's Island. By 1896, it became known internally that the real traitor was another general staff officer named Ferdinand Esterhazy, who testified against Dreyfus to deflect attention from himself, and whose handwriting matched the handwriting on the incriminating document. Major Hubert Joseph Henri forged documents to make it look like Dreyfus was guilty. The military suppressed the evidence and then induced the journalist Emile Zola to publish in 1898 an open letter to the French president entitled Jacques Hughes. He named names and he blamed Jew hatred for the verdict, and it was a sensation. Zola was tried twice for libel and convicted both times. Dreyfus was brought back after 5 years on Devil's Island. He was retried and he was convicted again. Such was the pervasiveness of the Jew hatred. But he was pardoned soon after that. He wasn't fully exonerated, though, until 1906. Dreyfus really was a French patriot and naive, he was a real Tom. After he was pardoned, he rejoined the army. He was promoted to major. He survived an assassination attempt, even fought for France in World War I, finishing his career as a lieutenant colonel and never losing his love for France. He died in 1935. For Seinfeld fans, Julia Louis-Dreyfus is a distant relative. Her direct ancestor was a cousin of Alfred Dreyfus, and they're from the same town in Alsace. But her father was Jewish. She's not Jewish, hence the Schicks appeal. Herzl covered the trial and was outraged, partly by the nature of the trial and the verdict, but mainly by the degradation of Dreyfus and the open Jew hatred it precipitated. Making Dreyfus representative of all Jews, despite the fact he was completely assimilated, informed Herzl that there was no hope for Jews, even in emancipated countries, that Jews would always be perpetual outsiders, and that the hatred was no longer a religious hatred. It really was a national and a racial hatred. And add to that the overt Jew hatred that was sweeping his new hometown of Vienna at the same time, electing in 1895 Karl Luger, the mayor of Vienna, on an openly anti-Jewish platform. His platform explicitly accused Jews of controlling the Austrian economy and the media, and not very well, traditional indictments until today. So Herzl realized that emancipation didn't help and that assimilation wouldn't work. It wasn't any longer a question of religious animus. So he pondered what other options were possible, and then he alighted on the conclusion that the only solution was a Jewish state. Now, no, he had no idea of Pinsker and Hess and Rav Akleh, he did, but he had no idea that anyone was even dealing in this area, no idea that Birnbaum had written anything. So he met with Baron Maurice de Hirsch in France, who was the leader at the time of Jewish colonization attempts in Argentina. Hirsch had sent already 6,000 Jews there, and Hirsch brushed him off, as did Rothschild, who was interested in the practical aspects of settling the land of Israel, but without any political dimension. So Herzl put his pen to paper, and over the course of a year, wrote and then published in February 1896 what became his famous work, Der Judenstaat, The Jewish State, published in Germany. 500 copies suddenly hit a bookstore one fair morning in February. It was a comprehensive program, to say the least. He thought it all out. He only read Pinsker's book after his own was published, and he lamented, had he known of Pinsker's auto-emancipation, would have made his work a little easier. The premise of Der Judenstaat was, I quote, the restoration of the Jewish state. The incentive was what he called the Jewish question. No one can deny the gravity of the situation of the Jews. Wherever they live in perceptible numbers, they are more or less persecuted. And he noted the political attacks, the physical assaults, the constant refrain, "Don't buy from the Jews," that undermined our economic stability. He urged people not to see his plan as a utopian dream, and he acknowledged that many Jews who want to assimilate and enjoy emancipation will not heed him, but they should know that Jew hatred will not disappear. I quote, "But I think we shall not be left in peace," end quote. "We're not permitted to merge ourselves or to live as anything but strangers." And he said, imploringly, "We are a people, one people." He said in the book, I have here my dog-eared edition of Der Judenstaat, that they tell us everything tends in fact to one and the same conclusion, which is clearly enunciated in that classic Berlin phrase, Juden raus, out with the Jews. I shall now put the Jewish question in the surest possible form. Are we to get out now? And if so, to what place? Or may we yet remain? And if so, how long? He derided previous attempts that focused on settlement and colonization, bringing Jews here to to the land of Israel and there to work the soil. This, he said, would not solve anything. So his plan was to form two agencies, what he called the Society of Jews and the Jewish Company. The Society of Jews would be the organization that would unite Jews and do the initial political work of securing a land, whereas the Jewish Company would do the practical work of helping Jews sell their businesses, move to the land of Israel, and sustain themselves there. He left open where this should be. He said it could be either Palestine or Argentina, noting the fertility and uninhabited space of Argentina, and what he called the marvelous potency of the land of Israel. But Herzl himself, for obvious reasons, preferred the land of Israel. He even envisioned a Jewish honor guard protecting the Christian holy places as a symbol of the solution to the Jewish question after 18 centuries of suffering, primarily at the hands of Christians. In brief, the Jewish Company would raise about $200 million. It was a business undertaking. Herzl was a capitalist, not a socialist. It would take possession of Jewish properties and businesses in Europe, sell them to non-Jews at market value, keep a commission for itself, pay some to the owners, and use the balance to establish a Jewish foothold in the new land. If a mass departure of Jews would drive down real estate prices, right, supply and demand, so the company would manage the property and the businesses until the right price could be obtained. With the money, they would buy land and they would start building dwellings for the workmen. They would have a 7-hour day in 3.5-hour shifts, meaning, let's say you start at 7, so a group would work until 10:30, they'd be off 3.5 hours, another group would work, the first group would come back, they would work 3.5 hours, the second group would come back, total workday 14 hours, they'd be paid 7 hours per individual, they'd be paid first in goods and later in money, there'd be no freeloaders, anyone who received had to do some type of work. This labor would create trade, agriculture would generate markets, markets would give rise to crafts. And when it was more established, then wealthy Jews would come from Europe and they would build fancy homes. And the company would raise capital through banks and then from the public. They'd even sell securities to generate income. The society would organize groups of Jews and be responsible for all details of migration and establishing the infrastructure for statehood. They would travel in groups, I quote, "Every group will have its rabbi traveling with his congregation. The rabbis will devote their energies to the service of our idea and will inspire the congregations by preaching it from the pulpit." He said, "Men will come first, then send for their wives and children," much like, he wrote, they do now when they immigrate to the United States, the late 1890s. "The middle class, lawyers, doctors, businessmen, will follow their sons, who will be officials of the society and the company. The main impetus will come," he said, "from the anti-Semites. There will be no beggars allowed. 10% of the manpower will be devoted to self-defense." He meant really against each other, because he didn't reckon at all with Arab objections. They weren't a factor then. "Every group can bring its own habits." You're talking about an amalgamation of Jews from across the world. So he said, and keep in mind, he was a bit of a dandy, Herzl. He wrote, "Just like there are Viennese cafes in South Africa and French theaters in Russia, so too in the new land. You'll have cafes and theaters and opera, the men in top hats, etc. When we journey out of Egypt again, we shall not leave the flesh pots behind." They would recreate the best of Europe in the new land. "The Society of Jews will devolve into the governing body of the Jewish state and even determine for the first time," I quote, "whether the Jews really wish to go to the promised land and whether they must go there. The land will be distributed in an orderly fashion, not like in America. He writes, in America, the occupation of newly opened territory is set about in naive fashion. The settlers assemble on the frontier, and at the appointed time, make a simultaneous and violent rush for their portions. We shall not proceed thus in the new land of the Jews. The land will be distributed in a very, very organized fashion. The state will have a constitution. Herzl favored a democratic monarchy and an aristocratic republic, much like you had in other countries in Europe, for very workable balance of power. He wasn't keen on a pure democracy. Now, Herzl wrote that Hebrew will not suffice as the common language. He didn't speak it, nor did most Jews. He insisted that people will give up what he called those miserable, stunted jargons. He obviously meant Yiddish. And in later writings, he assumed that German would be the national tongue, reflecting the world's most advanced culture. How ironic is that? But he saw that people would speak German primarily, and there'd be a place for Hebrew and Yiddish in individuals' homes. In a famous passage, still quoted today by the wrong sorts of people, he said the Jewish state would not be a theocracy. We shall keep our priests within the confines of their temples in the same way as we shall keep our professional army within the confines of their barracks. But Herzl was actually more deferential and respectful to rabbis than some of his successors, like Chaim Weizmann and the Russian Zionists who became leaders of the movement. The flag, he wrote, will be a white flag with seven golden stars, the seven golden hours of our working day. And he assumed that the nations of the world would support this endeavor, if only to get rid of their Jews. And he assumed as well that this would end Jew hatred. He was wrong on both counts. But Herzl felt, he really knew, that his main challenge would be convincing the Jews. Some will say his plans are too fanciful. Others that the persecution is not that bad. You get used to it. Others will say that if this were feasible, it would have been done long ago. He dismissed all those objections and he concluded, at the end of the book, therefore I believe that a wondrous generation of Jews will spring into existence. The Maccabees will rise again. The Jews who wish will have their state. We shall live at last as free men on our own soil and die peacefully in our own homes. The world will be freed by our liberty, enriched by our wealth, magnified by our greatness. He omitted any mention of the settlements then in Israel, possibly because he did not know much about them. Now, my edition that I have here was actually my father's, was published in New York in 1943, which is a very interesting year to be publishing the Der Judenstaat, and it contains, not just right in the middle of the Holocaust, but 5 years before the state came into existence, it has a foreword by Chaim Weizmann, who noted the reality that Herzl said nothing that was much different than what Hess or Pinsker had written before. And naturally, Weizmann omitted any mention, any reference to Rav Alkalai or Rav Kalischer. So the question Weizmann raises is the question, why then did Herzl succeed where the others failed? That is a good question. Weizmann suggested that maybe it was the Dreyfus affair, maybe it was the simplicity of Herzl's approach, but primarily, he thinks, it was due to Herzl's personality. His vision was grandiose, but his passions were even more extraordinary. Weizmann, his greatest qualities were humility and faith. He was not a humble man in the ordinary sense of the word, but he bore himself with a pride that bordered on haughtiness, and he fancied himself the leader of the Jews, that kings and ministers believed it, as did many Jews. If we can articulate one difference between Herzl and the others were theoreticians who then expected everyone else to coalesce around them and do the heavy lifting. it was Herzl was a theoretician, but then he basically said, I will lead the movement. I will see what I can do in order to bring it to fruition. So Herzl first tried to meet leading Jews. Again, Hirsch, Maurice de Hirsch, rebuffed him, as did Lord Rothschild. Baron Edmund, Hanadiv Yadua, met Herzl in July 1896, and he feared that Herzl's plans would harm his own settlement efforts. One mustn't have eyes bigger than one's stomach. Viennese Jews laughed at him. His own newspaper was critical. But he had some support. Nathan Birnbaum reached out to him, as did some rabbis, including of Hermann Adler, who's the chief rabbi of Britain. The chief rabbi of Sofia, Bulgaria, declared him to be the Mashiach, maybe slightly prematurely. Fortunately for Herzl, another person who did reach out to him was Max Nordau, also a Budapest native, medical doctor, and Nordau was far better known in Europe as a writer than was Herzl. Nordau was another unlikely figure in this story. He was raised religious, his father was a Rav, he went to yeshiva, and he completely rebelled by the time he was an older teenager. Nordau even intermarried. There's so many streets in Israel, Rehov Nordau. Nordau married a Danish woman. And Nordau was also living in Paris during the Dreyfus trial, and he was also taken aback by the overt Jew hatred. And at the same time, he had this experience which is recorded in a number of places. Remember, he was a physician. A Jewish mother came to see him with a child who was ill. Apparently, they had immigrated from Eastern Europe. The child barely spoke French. And when Dr. Nordau asked the child where he went to school, the child mumbled, Cheder. So Nordau asked him what he learned that day, and the child eagerly shared their learning Parshat Vayechi, Yaakov's plea to Yosef. And they learned the pasuk, Va'ani bevuimi padan, meitalai Rachel beretz kanan baderech, ba'od kivrat eretz lavo efrata. Yaakov said to Yosef, when I was coming from Padan, Rachel, your mother, died in Eretz Canaan, on the way a short distance from Ephrat. Vekbarei Hashem b'derech Ephrat hi Beit Lachem. And I buried her there on the way to Ephrat in Beit Lachem. And the famous Rashi, the boy continued there, states that Yaakov was apologizing to Yosef for not burying his mother in Hebron, but you should know that when we go into exile, Rachel will go out and see the Jews leaving, ubocha, crying, umivakesh atalim rachamim, and she'll beg for mercy on their behalf. Shenemar, the pasuk in Yirmiyahu, kol beraman ishma, Rachel mivakol banel, a voice on high is heard, Rachel crying for her children. Vakarosh Baruch Hu Meshiva, and God answers, Yesh Sachar Lefulatech Num Hashem. There is a reward for all your efforts. Vishavu Vanim Ligvulam, and the children will return to their borders. Nordau, who was then overwhelmed by the Dreyfus case, said to himself, a nation that remembers where its ancestors are buried is an eternal nation. They will never assimilate. And this lingered in his mind. Not long thereafter, Herzl went to see Nordau, whom he knew from Budapest days, and from Vienna as well, and from France, who was also a physician, to see that if he is sane or not, and to share his thoughts and plans. They spoke for several days, after which Nordau purportedly said to Herzl, if you are insane, we are insane together. The advantage of Nordau joining Herzl's efforts was that Nordau was much more grounded than Herzl, who remained the dreamer. Nordau was much more practical. Herzl, in June 1897, founded a Zionist newspaper called the Die Welt, the world, and he called a conference for all interested parties to be held in Basel, Switzerland, because the Jewish community of Munich, his first choice, rejected it. The first Zionist Congress was called to order August 29th, 1897, it was an event. I have here an invitation, if anybody wants to go. The invitation was written in Hebrew, and it said the first 3 days of Elul, Yitasvu Choveitzim B'chol Ratzot, LeKongres HaTzioni BeBasel BeShveitz. On the first 3 days of Elul, lovers of Zion will gather from all countries to the Zionist Congress in Basel. And on that day, when all the scattered Jews with one mind, Yayom Nitzachon Tchiyat Lumeinu, it'll be a day of victory for the renaissance of our nation. Da'aseifa beBasel tiatchalat kufa chadasha pitpatchut tenuatenu. The Congress in Basel will be the beginning of a new era in the development of our movement. And it goes on to say that all Jews are going to gather, and the Congress, Shoef l'matarot kravot v'shariot, the Congress yearns to have short-term possible objectives, achievements. Anything else you hear about these plans, klutot min avir, they're just from the Luft. And they emphasize that whatever they do will be open, transparent, it will not be violative of the law of any land, nor, and this really weighed on the Jews' minds, nor will it impact on the civil rights of any Jew in any country. And it says, "Bazene vakeshotcha adon nechbad," we ask you, honorable master and your friend, to come and join in Basel, etc. It was signed Dr. Theodore Herzl, Rosh Havad, Dr. Marcus Ehrenpreis, Hamazkir. Well, the delegate card had a picture of Jews at the Kotel on the one side and a Jew planting on the other. And the invitation took care to underscore that everything would be legal and Jews would be protected as a result. It began with a Shechianu by Karpel Lippa, a Romanian doctor who's a member of Chovei Tzion. They met for 3 days, 208 delegates in all from 16 countries in the grand hall of the Basel Casino. Talk about a gamble. Herzl financed the conference from his own money, really his wife's money, and he insisted everyone wear formal clothing, top hats, tails, etc. On the first day, Nordau spoke, and he noted Rashi's comment from Parashat Vayechi, and he also said, there's now a European conscience that Jew hatred exists, but we don't really have to fear a massacre, because since there's now a European conscience, a world conscience, that does not tolerate mass crimes. There is irony in that all the proceedings and the program were conducted in German. But the delegates were wowed by Herzl, not least of all because of his appearance, his charisma, his royal bearing. Yechi HaMelech, many cried out. The Congress adopted the Basel platform, calling for a publicly recognized and legally secured home in Palestine for the Jewish people. Herzl's equivocation on venue was at least temporarily resolved. The Congress was clear. They wanted the land of Israel, nothing else. Notice how they didn't ask for a state, which one young delegate, Leo Motzkin of Kiat Motzkin fame, thought a mistake. They founded the Zionist organization to further these goals. They adopted HaTikva as the anthem. They subsumed all the Chovei Tzion entities that were in Israel already. They elected Herzl the president and Nordau among the vice presidents. They also discussed the People's Bank, what Herzl proposed as the Jewish company. In fact, that was established at the second Zionist Congress 1 year later, also in Basel, as the Jewish Colonial Trust, which a few years later morphed into Bank Lumi, which still exists, National Bank. Herzl's goal of raising $200 million fell a little short. He raised about $1 million. The second conference also adopted the blue and white flag and was attended by Chaim Weizmann. Weizmann was instrumental in raising awareness among Russian Jews, who eventually became dominant in the movement, supplanting the Western Europeans and the Central Europeans. It was a very small religious delegation. The leader was Rav Shmuel Moliver, who was a member of the executive, but already religious concerns were taking a back seat to other issues. Rav Moliver died in 1898, but his approach would soon be adopted by Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, who founded Mizrahi, Merkaz Ruchani, in 1901, the religious Zionist movement that would work within the system. I hear rumors they still exist. We'll know soon enough in a few months. The media played up the Congress. It was quite the romantic notion. Jews and ancient people returned to their ancient land. Herzl was quite pleased, famously writing in his diary 1 week later, September 3rd, 1897, were I to sum up the Basel Congress in a word, which I shall guard against pronouncing publicly, it would be this: at Basel, I founded the Jewish state. If I said this out loud today, I would be greeted by universal laughter. In 5 years, perhaps, and certainly in 50 years, everyone will perceive it. Almost exactly 50 years later, it came to pass, but much would happen before then. And it's that iconic image of Herzl that you see in back of me, which really summarizes the thought, his brooding nature, his romantic nature, his philosophical nature, just gazing out over a bridge into a distance. So that picture really summarizes, in a sense, what the Jews of the time saw in Herzl and what they expected from the Congress. This is a slightly less iconic image. That's me in the same spot, pondering how I'm supposed to get back to the hotel now that the bus left without me. In any event, in the Megillat Atzmut, this event, the first Zionist Congress, was so important that it made reference to it. Bishnat Tafresh Nun Zayin, 1897, Nitkanes HaKongres HaTzioni L'Kol Kriyato Shehogeh Chazon HaMedina Yehudit, Theodor Herzl. The first Zionist Congress gathered, responding to the call of the Chozeh HaMedina, the visionary of the Jewish state, Theodor Herzl, V'chriz Al Zchut Ha'am HaYehudi L'Tkuma L'Umit Barzo. And it proclaimed the right of the Jewish nation for a national revival in its land. It's interesting, they didn't quite talk about rights, but that's what they wanted in the Megillat Atzmut. It had an effect. A year later, the Second Congress doubled the number of delegates who came, and the number of Zionist groups across Europe grew in 1 year from 117 to 913. Herzl began meeting world leaders. Kaiser Wilhelm he met twice, once in Israel. The Kaiser telling Herzl he would like nothing more than to get rid of his Jews. Quote, the sooner they take off, the better. He met officials in Turkey and Russia. Years later, he met the Sultan, who had dodged him at first. Later, Britain. But in all these cases, the reaction that he got ranged from non-committal at best to hostile at worst. January 26, 1904, Herzl met Pope Pius X at the Vatican. That meeting went especially poorly. Herzl shook but refused to kiss the Pope's hand, which was the protocol. Pope was taken aback, but Herzl refused. On account of Jewish pride, he made his pitch, and the Pope responded, we cannot give approval to this movement. We cannot prevent the Jews from going to Jerusalem, but we could never sanction it. The soil of Jerusalem, if it was not always sacred, has been sanctified by the life of Jesus. As the head of the church, I cannot tell you anything different. The Jews have not recognized our Lord, therefore we cannot recognize the Jewish people, end quote. And that became church policy for the next 90 years. world leaders were dismissive. As the Kaiser told Herzl, for a Jewish state to come into being, the German, Russian, Austro-Hungarian, and Ottoman empires would have to collapse. The likelihood of any one of that occurring is slim. That all four should disintegrate is impossible. And yet, Chasdei Hashem, Yatzev Gvulot Amim Usar B'nei Yisrael, within 2 decades, all those empires were gone, as if overnight. But before that would happen, the Zionist movement would go to war with itself several times, leaving Herzl disillusioned, but never totally despairing. He had spent most of his wife's fortune. There'd be the Uganda diversion, internal politics, and the reality that for all of Herzl's passion, the movement for a Jewish state was not shared by most Jews. In 1902, Herzl wrote a novel entitled Altneuland, in which he envisioned the Jewish state coming into being, but his vision is really nothing we would recognize today. When Herzl died in Austria, July 3rd, 1904, age 44 years old, of a heart problem, the movement was leaderless. Herzl had ordered no eulogies be given. He was eulogized anyway. He directed that he should be buried next to his father in Austria, and he was, until the Jewish people take his remains to Israel. He was reburied on Har Herzl in 1949, 45 years later, 1 year after the state was declared. He said before he died, "I gave my heart's blood for my people." His family soon fell apart, and so he has no survivors, no descendants. One daughter was murdered during the Holocaust, his wife was cremated, but his 2 children and 1 grandson, who had committed suicide, they've all been reburied on Har Herzl as well. Part of the Jewish world mourned Herzl's death. A newly arrived in Israel, Rav Kook, eulogized Herzl himself, a speech that was grossly misconstrued when Rav Kook said that Herzl played a Mashiach ben Yosef role, Mashiach ben Yosef, the Messiah, who will rebuild the material infrastructure of Jewish life and pave the way for Mashiach ben David. Rav Kook's enemies accused him of calling Herzl Mashiach ben Yosef, which of course he did not do. In Brisk, the secretary of the Jewish town council asked that the great synagogue of Brisk be used for a eulogy for Herzl. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav of Brisk, adamantly refused, and he locked the door. The secretary either had his own key or broke the lock, depending on who tells the story, and a eulogy was given. That secretary was Zev Dov Begin. 8 years later, he became the father of Menachem Begin. Herzl was a tremendous success in retrospect, not as much while he lived. He was truly one of the greatest and most mysterious figures in Jewish history. The main impediment was the failure to attract the mass support of Jews. Why Jews overwhelmingly dismiss the Zionist endeavor with attitudes that endure until today, that will be our next subject. I thank you all very much.